Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show by deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm taking a look at the myths and religions of the world and seeing what inspiration we can find in them for fantasy role-playing games. In this season, we've been looking at the mythology, legends, and folklore of Hawaii. We started with some of the major deities of the setting and now we're kind of taking a look at some of the other more legendary or folkloric rather than mythical figures. If you've read the classic Deities and Demigods book for AD&D First Edition, you'll know that each of the sections about a pantheon, not all of them, but many of them, have other kind of creatures here and there in them. So the example I always return to is the Fossagrim in the Norse mythology section, but there are other ones like the Cyclops in the Greek myth one. So this is my way of saying that it's justified for me to be talking about Hawaiian monsters, because not everything in the format that we're inspired by is a deity per se. Rather than just saying that, you know, I can do what I like because it's my show and I hope that you'll enjoy hearing about them. We all have our own limitations and this is one of mine. Anyway, if our hypothetical Hawaiian section were to have a small number of monsters, what sort of things would they be? Actually, having said that, I don't know that my first set of creatures are monsters per se. They're just people, or maybe not just. These are cannibals. Cannibals are very much the villains in a lot of Hawaiian stories, and sometimes they represent whole communities of cannibals. So there'll be stories about how man-eaters, often with their own chief and their own social structure, come from somewhere else and set up in Hawaii. So there are lots of accusations also that the people of a particular place are cannibals. And cannibalism is clearly seen as this act that puts you really almost outside of humanity. That cannibals are monstrous humans who violate kind of core restrictions of civilized behavior. I said that sometimes the cannibals are whole communities, but other times they are single individuals or small groups who live among other Hawaiian communities, and their sort of identity has to be discovered when people start to go missing. One common theme in both versions of these stories are stories about a woman who is married to a cannibal and finds out who he is, like discovers his secret identity, and in particular discovers that he wants to eat her brother, and therefore she sort of denounces him. One version of the brother versus husband motif appears in a story about this guy, Lotu. Now, Lotu works for this character, Kalo Ai Kanaka, Lo the Man-Eater. Right, Kanaka just means a man, a person. And Lo the Man-Eater is the villain in a number of cannibal stories, but in this case, it's his kind of sidekick, Lotu. Lotu builds a house in like a mountain pass, and so when travelers come by, he ambushes them, and then he pushes them off a cliff. And again, this is a pretty common method of killing people in Hawaiian folktales or Hawaiian legends, and indeed in Hawaiian history, right? We remember that story about the battle during the Wars of Unification in which all these people leapt off this cliff rather than surrender. I mean, it's a mountainous environment, so cliffs and gorges are a pretty common sort of feature of the landscape. But so in this story, Lotu is going to eat his wife's brother. And in fact, he eats several of her brothers until one of them, thanks to her warning, is able to escape. And he goes off to Kauai. I think he's in Oahu. He goes off to Kauai to learn how to wrestle. And then he returns and grapples with Lotu, and they both wind up going over the cliff together, kind of Sherlock Holmes style. Other versions of the story in which the two, you know, the hero and the antagonist grapple and they go over the cliff together, have the person being grappled off the cliff actually being Kalo Ai Kanaka himself. So this seems to be a pretty common motif, and this idea of learning how to wrestle is actually something that we're going to see coming up a lot, because with the story of the cannibals, we seem to be getting more into the kind of the everyday world of Hawaiians, right? That these are, you know, ordinary travelers who are being ambushed as they come through this mountain pass. They're not necessarily carrying weapons around. I don't know why the brother doesn't tool up, but he doesn't seem to be a particularly martial character. In these stories, you can really, even in kind of summaries, I think you can detect the horror in which this idea of cannibalism was held. We know, remember that we talked about early on, that Hawaiian society had a great deal of restrictions, kapu, that surrounded food. Preparing and consuming food was quite strictly regulated. There were a lot of rules about who could make what kind of food, when they could make it, who could eat it, where they could eat it, when they could eat it, so on and so forth. you know, food is something that is within the, I mean, everything is, but food certainly is, within these rules that kind of denote sacredness. So this act of eating the ultimate kapu food, the ultimate, like, violation of kapu, is, in a way, more than just a murder, but like a form of blasphemy. Maybe that's also the reason for the kind of, like, throwing people over a cliff, because it's not a very heroic thing to do, whereas if he had, like, fought them and killed them with a war club or a spear, that would be more like actions that Hawaiian heroes do that are celebrated. Some of the tales are actually about how the cannibal eats even one of their own family members, which is, of course, a huge transgression. And in one of these tales, there's a detail about how the place where the victims were eaten is now cursed. And so nobody lives there. And again, you can see that this is one of those kind of just-so stories about why a particular place is the way it is. But the horror in which people hold this act of cannibalism, I think, is really clearly communicated through that. So cannibals here, you know, especially ambushing travelers, but also kind of having their own communities, they kind of fall into the role in a fantasy game of like an ogre or something, right? Like the horror of being eaten, even by someone who's kind of like your host. Another kind of person who maybe fills a similar role is the olohe. So olohe are sometimes called dog people, and in some versions of the story, they have dog tails, or in others, they just have dogs, like they have these special fierce dogs that they train to attack people. The olohe are said to be bandits. They live in remote areas. They lurk in caves, again, like mountainous country, and they ambush travelers. And they are said to be exceptionally skilled at wrestling and at lua. Now, we haven't talked about lua, which is a form of Hawaiian martial art. It's referred to in a lot of sources as the bone-breaking art. It's also sometimes called ku'ialua. It includes both armed and unarmed combat techniques, and it has a long history. Indeed, it's been formally taught ever since the kingdom of Hawaii. It was King Kamehameha II who established schools to teach people the art of lua. And of course, that merely institutionalized an existing martial arts tradition that had been in Hawaiian culture for a long time. So lua is, you know, the training program for warriors. And that kind of warlike skill is associated in particular with the nobility. And Kamehameha II's schools initially were only open to members of the ali'i, the nobility. One interesting thing about olohe is that, it may be olohe, actually. Olohe may mean a master of lua, because what it literally means is a hairless person. The reason for this is that olohe are hairless. Like, this again is just kind of one of their other, like, it's not monstrous, but it's a little bit weird qualities. But masters of lua are sometimes said to shave off all of their hair, both on their head and on their body, in order to make it easier for them to slip out of wrestling holds. Like, you can't grab onto their hair, you know, there won't be as much traction. And before they fight, they will rub themselves with coconut oil to make themselves slippery and hard to hold on to. Of course, this image is sort of like, I don't know that if I told the players that they were confronted by an all but nude, super buff, hairless man glistening with coconut oil, they would necessarily think, uh-oh, this is a killer, it's time for a fight. But they would soon learn, you know, they'd pick it up quickly. The olohe also have other qualities that make them good role-playing game antagonists. I mentioned that they live in caves, in essentially dungeons, and they even set traps in them. So there's one story in which we have an olohe who lives in a cave and has a big wooden beam that he's rigged up so that he can drop it on people as they come in. Like, there's, you know, a wire or a rope or something that he can release, and they can crash down on anyone who comes through the door. Olohe villains not uncommonly have two daughters. That seems to be like a very specific stereotype of like the man who lives by the side of the road and his two daughters. Other dog monsters include ku'ilioloa, a dog with a human body, which I guess means it's like a jackalware type situation where it's a dog that can turn into a person or a dog that has human qualities. Ku'ilioloa is an antagonist of Kamapua'a. And I think we talked about Kamapua'a in the Pele episode, but it's possible we didn't, so let's go over him really quickly. He is another animal person, but he is heroic. He is a shape-shifting pig man, and he is a kupua. He comes from the island of Maui, and he is kind of a rowdy boy. He has some fertility powers in addition to his usual shape-shifting and super strength. He loves Pele and tries to win her, but she rejects him initially and calls him a pig and the son of a pig. I mean, which would be a normal thing for a pig to be, you'd think. But they get into a kind of magical duel, and eventually he overcomes her, or doesn't, depending on the version of the tale. But one of the things he does is he can turn the, like, barren volcanic rock into fertile land, like, so great are his kind of life powers. And he seems like a good kind of, you know, he's a sort of chaotic character. He represents, like, the irrepressible vitality of life, springing up in the unlikeliest places, impatient of control and authority. Anyway, he kills Ku'ili'oloa by the old kind of folktale trick where he uses his plant form, you know, he uses his magical, like, plant shifting ability to induce Ku'ili'oloa to eat him, and then he shifts back into his normal form and fights his way out from the inside. So dogs, and we've talked about dog men before, we mentioned him in a previous episode, so this idea of, I think when we were talking about kupua generally, and the idea that kupua can sometimes have animal shapes or animal bodies. Another type of creature or spirit who can be both harmful or benevolent are the mo'o. And mo'o are kind of a, like, nature or water, particularly, spirit. They turn up a lot in the quest of Hi'iaka, remember?
The younger sister of Pele,
who undertakes this great odyssey. And that makes sense. Like, Beckwith thinks that this represents, you know, a sort of symbolic rivalry between water, represented by the mo'o water spirits. And, of course, Hi'iaka is from a family of fire deities, so that this is a kind of elemental opposition. Mo'o are often represented as lizards, giant lizards, or even regular lizards, and they're said to live in bodies of water like fish ponds, and to be protectors of those fish ponds. Again, like in our episode in the Menehune, we talked about the importance of fish ponds to the sort of aquaculture of pre-colonization Hawaii. But Mo'o aren't all good, and like a lot of other supernatural beings, they're shapeshifters. A lot of shapeshifters in this mythology, well, I mean, it's not unusual, a lot of shapeshifters in a lot of mythology, and in particular, the motif of the sort of shapeshifting bride seems to be one that's commonly associated with mo'o. So one example is a mo'o called Kalama'inu, who meets a guy when they are surfing. Again, the surfing motif. Surfing seems to be a way in which, like, romantic partners meet a lot in these myths. I guess the idea is that surfing is a time when people are, like, showing off, they're displaying their prowess, they're displaying, like, their good looks, I suppose. I mean, there's an element of that in surfing in contemporary culture, I would think. So she meets this guy surfing, and she takes him away, and by, while they are both surfing, getting him to come onto her surfboard, which sounds like a challenge. Although, you know, if we go back to the Isabella Bird description of surf riding or surf bathing, we see that surfing may be a little bit different in this period. But anyway, she takes him away to be her husband, and they live together happily for a while until he gets the urge to go surfing again. And she says he can go, but he must be careful not to speak to anybody else, because apparently he's the only person who doesn't know that she is a mo'o. And she gives him a surfboard and tells him to go, you know, have a good time. But he runs into some people, and they explain that he's been married to a mo'o, and in fact, that it's not a surfboard that he is carrying, but her tongue. Now, see, this is an example of one of those stories where you feel like you've got the hang of it, and then your lack of cultural context is brought really sharply to your attention. Because, so what happens is, he goes back to confront her, and she admits it, and asks him to stay with her anyway, and they are, like, reconciled, I guess? Reconciled? Anyway, they stay together. And she goes off to hunt down the two people who snitched her out for being a mo'o, and they flee her, and at one point they hide in the ocean, and she goes after them by, like, making a wooden contraption that she can use to catch them, and that's how fish traps were invented. And the point of the story is, that's where fish traps came from. Although there are other versions of the story where they don't stay together, even when he finds out she's a mo'o. Because again, you know, what we are dealing with is, I don't quite know how to put this, but there are a lot of sort of folklore studies where we know that there are folk tales that exist in innumerable variations all over the world, right? So that there's, you know, not just one version of Cinderella, or there's not just one version of Hansel and Gretel. But what happens is that a kind of literary version of the story becomes the default, and then because that is read and enjoyed and retold by ordinary people, then they sort of become harmonized in a way, more so than would kind of be the case in a culture that was not, you know, where people were not reading these stories and all reading versions of the same story. But that isn't what happens in Hawaii, because the collection and publication of these mo'olelo, oh, I don't know if this story is mo'olelo, but the collection and publication of Hawaiian folklore and Hawaiian mythology are happening at the same time that the kingdom is developing its widespread and diverse literary culture. So there isn't a standardized version of these texts, I don't think. I don't know that we can point to one and say, that is the one and all these others are variants of it. But the idea of the mo'o presenting an alluring front and then turning out to be something else is a pretty common one. Some of the details are great. In one of the stories, the mo'o is discovered because she is seen to be eating spiders and spider webs. Eating spider webs, that's a horrible image, and yet one that would fit right in with any kind of, like, you know, spine-chilling tale of terror. It's a very universal horror image, even though I'm not familiar with it from any other place. Eating spiders, sure, that's in Dracula. So on this reading, the mo'o is basically like a hag. And honestly, I think hags as marsh spirits is a better read on them than, or is more fun than hags as kind of apprentice junior devils, which is what they are in D&D, and is kind of based around the idea that, you know, that's what witches are, right? That witches are like the servants of Satan. But I feel like that's a very local and, like, specific understanding of witchcraft, and I'd rather have the hag be this, like, dangerous, tricky spirit than kind of like hag as junior devil. I mean, the clue's in the junior. That's the problem, right? Is that it's just doing the same kind of thing that devils and evil high priests and what have you do anyway. You know, it's a little bit redundant. Speaking of spine-chilling tales of terror, of course, Hawaiian folklore also contains ghosts. And there are a couple of ghost stories in Beckwith. I think my favorite one is the story of the Blazing Head. There's these two guys, and they are traveling, and they take shelter in a cave. But there's a fire, and I guess the bedding of one of them catches fire, and he's burned all the way up to his neck. And the other one manages to escape, and he, like, goes running back down to get back home, you know, to get away from this. And the head is, like, flying after him, still on fire, calling out for him to come back. I think that idea of, you know, not just a ghost, but the ghost of your friend whom you saw die, that's particularly horrific. And also this idea that it seems to be that it just wants him to get burned up too. Like, he was burned up, so why shouldn't he be burned up? But I just think the image is really impressive. Like, the Blazing Head would be a fun ghost. It reminds me a little bit of the Rokurokubi. So we have these creatures. How are we going to apply them in a game? I think for game purposes, we want to separate out the cannibals and the olohe. Like, in the actual stories, it seems to me that they perform very similar narrative functions, right? That their goal is to be antagonists and obstacles for, you know, either, maybe the main difference is that the olohe, like, often are obstacles in the path. Like, they sit in a particular location, and anyone who wants to get through it has to, like, defeat them, right? Engage in a trial of strength of some kind. Whereas the cannibals maybe go after a person more, like where the cannibal's wife is able to find out that this specific person, her brother, is threatened. But I think for our purposes, we should split out the cannibals and make them the undercover monsters, the insidious threat within society. Your neighbor could be a cannibal and you might not know it. Those tales aren't very big on motive, but there are some where it appears that the cannibal just has, like, this hunger that they can't control, that appears one day and can't be ignored, which might arguably indicate some kind of outside agency. It doesn't seem that he thinks that he's going to be getting any benefit from eating people, so it's not one of those eat people become immortal type of situations. And then that leaves the olohe as an external hazard, right? The ones who make traveling on your own dangerous. They kind of fill our bugbear slot, like they're powerful foes who rely on brute strength, cunning, and mastery of the martial arts. And they're there to kind of make the wilderness world a little more challenging and to explain why travelers go in big groups or whatever, but you need to get the Blue Jewel to the Heiau at such and such a time, and so you need to go running through the mountains in the middle of the night, and that means you might run into some Olohe. When the king comes with his guards, they lay low. So like the Menehune, one of the things that the Mo'o achieve, I think, is that they do something that is very important for Hawaiian myth, which is that they make the landscape much more actively spiritual. So we saw that even when we got up to the highest ranks of the Hawaiian cosmology, when we were talking about Lono, Ku, Kane, and Kanaloa, Kane and Kanaloa, they live in Hawaii in essentially mortal form. And there are all these places that are said to be sacred to them. And it's the same for like stones that are said to be sacred to Ku, and so on and so forth. These deities are very present in the landscape, and the landscape is full of stories of them. So it's not going to be like, if you think of a typical D&D, you know, hex map, you won't find very many places where it says that, like, oh yes, this is where a god used to live, or this thing was put here by a god, or a god did this, or a god did that, right? Now, in Glorantha, it might be another matter, because Greg Stafford, you know, I would eat my hat if Greg Stafford hadn't read Martha Warren Beckwith's Hawaiian mythology. It would astound me. Because the model of cosmology that the ostensibly polytheistic D&D religions have is one that's much more akin to not even just Christianity, but Protestantism, right? People are on earth and God is in heaven. You know, Catholicism has a more, the landscape is full of saints and it's full of the things that saints did. So there's, you know, it's maybe somewhere in between. That's a huge oversimplification. Catholics and Protestants, don't at me. You know what I'm talking about. And I want to suggest that the influence of Protestant Christianity is present everywhere in Dungeons & Dragons, even though individual creators, I mean, Gary Gygax, for instance, may not be Protestants properly so-called. I don't want to get into a complex argument about where we categorize Jehovah's Witnesses, but he lived within that cultural milieu. Indeed, as do American Catholics in the main. The American landscape isn't seen in that holy way, even to the extent that medieval Christians saw the European landscape. And other parts of the world landscape, but Europe is the one I know about. But that is very much not the position that Hawaiian mythology takes. It has sacred landscapes full of supernatural beings, and it should definitely be, if we're doing a Hawaiian-inspired, or if we're taking some elements of inspiration from Hawaiian myth for a fantasy setting, one of the things that we should definitely take is that idea of a spiritually or magically or religiously active landscape. So even though we have some monsters that are quite practical, that are, you know, brawlers and fighters, I think that their presence and the presence of other supernatural creatures, or like Kupua and Aumakua in general, help us make the world a little fuller of magic, which is one of the main things that we want to have in our post-Hawaiian mythology setting. Speaking of which, next episode is going to be our final episode in this season about Hawaiian mythology. I'm going to put up the poll for what we're going to cover next, but in the interim, I'm going to cover a couple of different things for little one-shot episodes. You know, this is a big project. I learned a lot. It was really enjoyable, but I want to take a couple of more contained topics before I go on to the next big one. So I'll put up the poll. Please fill it out. And in our next episode, before we do our interseason break, we'll take a look at what we've learned and what we can adapt from these stories into fantasy settings. So I hope that you will join me then for Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.